taken out to an airstrip, ordered to board the plane, and I basically just sat down on the runway near the plane, and because of the public support I'd received, because of like the media coverage, and because of my hunger strike, all those kind of things came together where they did not actually pick me up and throw me on the plane.
From the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, it's time for the Weekly Freak Show. Headlines and highlights for the week ending Thursday, January 25th, 2001. My name's the V-Man, and I'll be your host for this half-hour look back at the news and features not heard in or glanced over by the corporate-controlled media. On this week's program, we'll hear from conscientious objector and Gulf War resister Jeff Patterson on his experiences following a decision to oppose military intervention in the Middle East. Plus, this week's Spotlight Sound. Stand by for the Weekly Freak Show, coming up next. And now, headlines for the week ending Thursday, January 25th, 2001. Despite grassroots support from people across the country who gathered in street demonstrations and had flooded the White House with faxes and phone calls, on Saturday, January 20th, outgoing U.S. President Bill Clinton denied, without comment, a request for clemency filed on behalf of Leonard Peltier. Convicted in the 1975 deaths of two FBI agents after a shootout on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, Peltier's supporters maintain he never received the benefit of a fair trial. The United States Attorney readily admits that no one knows who fired the fatal shots that killed the agents. President Clinton ended his tenure Saturday by pardoning 140 Americans, including his brother Roger, Whitewater business partner Susan McDougal, and 1970s kidnapped heiress Patricia Hearst. The orders Clinton signed 2 hours before leaving office also wiped the records of two former cabinet confidants, ex-CIA Director John Deutsch and ex-housing chief Henry Cisneros. Upwards of 300,000 people turned out in Washington, D.C. for the inauguration of George W. Bush as the 43rd President of the United States on January 20th. Under the tightest security restrictions ever during a presidential inauguration, anyone wishing to attend the inaugural parade was required to pass through one of 9 police checkpoints, have their bags searched, and in some cases be frisked and have protest signs confiscated. All told, about 10,000 officers had been deployed from various law enforcement agencies and were coordinated by the Secret Service. Legal observers reported the use of pepper spray and billy clubs by the D.C. Metropolitan Police. The Black Bloc was followed by police cars all morning. Black blockers slowed traffic around the parade route by dragging newspaper kiosks into the streets in front of police. Soon after, D.C. police appeared and managed to corral about 80 of this group against a wall. A standoff ensued between the police, spectators, and a groundswell of protesters, suddenly reinforced by the unexpected arrival of demonstrators from the Justice Action Movement, when they outnumbered police, forcing them to release surrounded black blockers who were about to be arrested. Not much later, with the reunited black bloc at the front, a group of participants grabbed a fairly large cart parked in front of a vacant construction site. This cart soon came careening down an overlooking hill, crashing through a police checkpoint, only to be stopped from going into the parade avenue by a Secret Service car which pulled in front of its path, damaging the vehicle. Hundreds of demonstrators rushed through and sat in the street to block the parade route. Soon after, 4 black blockers scaled the nearby Navy Memorial flagpole and pulled down the nautical flags, which were replaced by black and red anarchist flags, as well as an upside-down U.S. flag. Meanwhile, the parade had been delayed. When the Bush motorcade eventually did arrive, the cars sped by this concentrated protest area. A single egg reportedly landed on the presidential motorcade. In the end, there were 9 arrests made during the protests, 2 on felony charges. In Louisville, Kentucky, the Earth Liberation Front has claimed responsibility for damages in the first wave of attacks against what the group calls corporate sprawl. On Tuesday, January 23rd, two nearly finished buildings, including a PNC bank, suffered five broken windows, while another 18 windows were vandalized, causing an estimated $800 in damage. An anonymous communique issued by the ELF stated, "The once beautiful farmlands of eastern Jefferson, Kentucky, are being destroyed by earth rapers at the expense of corporate profit. This was the first, be it minor, direct action attempt to the sprawl. It will be a long-fought battle, and more actions are planned in the future." No arrests have been made in Tuesday's action. Meanwhile, in the early hours of Thursday, January 25th, Bloomington, Indiana area environmental activist Frank Ambrose was arrested by state conservation officers and charged with timber spiking. The charge is listed as a Class D felony, which can carry up to 3 years in prison and a fine. The arrest stems from an act of economic sabotage claimed by the Earth Liberation Front. On June 26, 2000, ELF activists entered two timber sales in Brown and Monroe counties, then placed hundreds of spikes in trees set to be cut. They then released a communique publicly claiming credit for the action and warning timber companies not to cut. Ambrose, whose home was raided by federal agents on July 19, 2000, in relation to the incident, is maintaining his innocence. He will be arraigned February 2nd. And finally, on Thursday, January 25th, 2001, riot police in Lille, France, were sprayed with firefighting foam during a demonstration of 600 firemen in the main square of the northern French city. Protesting the lack of resources afforded them by the government to ensure safety on the job, some of the firefighters mounted a ladder and let loose an arc of foam from their fire extinguishers. Police charged them without warning, swinging their clubs and firing tear gas. Several firemen were injured in the violent clashes that followed, including Edward Walzak, 58, whose right hand was blown off after a stun grenade thrown by riot police exploded. Walzak, who is to retire in 6 months, was holding the device when it detonated. "His hand was literally torn off," said colleague Christian Gillot. Four firefighters were detained by police and later released. And those were headlines for the week ending Thursday, January 25th, 2001. Just hours before the inauguration of George W. Bush to the U.S. presidency, United States and British warplanes killed six Iraqi civilians in airstrikes over southern Iraq. In 1990, Jeff Patterson was a corporal in the United States Marine Corps, trained to use nuclear artillery as well as biological and chemical weapons. During his time in the Marines, Jeff became increasingly disillusioned with the U.S. military's interventions in foreign affairs. In August of that year, Jeff found himself stationed in Hawaii with just a few weeks left on a 4-year enlistment. Because of his nuclear artillery experience, Jeff was one of the first to be deployed to Saudi Arabia as a part of Operation Desert Shield. With the help of some anti-war activists he met, Jeff decided he was going to oppose the war on Iraq, stating he would not be a pawn in America's plays for power and profit. Here, Jeff describes to Freak Radio's Old Lady Scar Arms the events that followed his refusal to deploy.
One night I hooked up with this lawyer, and the next day, instead of going back to work, instead of, packing my bags, I skipped work that day, held a press conference, some press came, went back the next morning, people had seen me on TV, they immediately, my commanding officer immediately took me aside and read me, five articles from the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which I was in violation of. Article 134 is the notorious any conduct unbecoming of the military service. Basically, it's vague enough to, put somebody in jail for anything they don't even vaguely like. yet. They still want to make an example on me by sending me, to the Middle East. So, you know, despite what people have seen on TV, well, you know, this guy's a punk. He's just going to go anyways. Back and forth, I start a hunger strike because the military, you know, told me I was going, but they were telling the media and my supporters that, nah, I wasn't going to go.
And at this point, you still didn't know what type of punishment they were going to bring down on you.
Yeah, they were coming up with their charges, but they were still minor. I hadn't gone AWOL yet. I hadn't actually refused to deploy for a troop movement. I just promised to refuse to deploy. So all that went on for like 3 weeks, and then on August 30th, my commanding officer, asked for volunteers to be kind of to lead the way for the larger unit. So they needed like 12 people, and, I was actually, quote-unquote, volunteered. Against my will.
Who volunteered you?
By my commanding officer. So, that night I was taken out to an airstrip on Kaneohe Marine Corps Air Station on the north side of Hawaii, Oahu. Ordered to board the plane. And I basically just sat down on the runway near the plane, and I think because of the public support I'd received, because of like the media coverage, and because of my hunger strike, all those kind of things came together where they did not actually pick me up and throw me on the plane, which they did to other resistors in subsequent months.
Physically forced them to board the plane.
Physically put them in shackles. Yeah.
And then boarded them to go to the Gulf.
That's right. They actually physically, one person in particular, an African-American, was shackled and carried onto an aircraft to the Gulf after he applied for discharge as a conscientious objector, which was denied. During this time, I also applied for, a discharge as a conscientious objector. A week before that, I had never heard of what this was and no idea, what this was. But, in the end, they said I wasn't sincere enough in my opposition to war.
So they refused the discharge?
They just wholesale said I wasn't actually really that sincere, which is, their judgment call.
So they told you that you were volunteered, even though you didn't volunteer to go, and then what happened?
Well, again, I was, that night I was taken to the airstrip. I sat down. Watched, friends I had lived with for 4 years march by, had my commanding officer, my master sergeant, naval investigator, just jumping around, yelling. They're screaming, look at the women getting on the plane. Those women got bigger balls than you punk. You have a right, faggot, queer, chicken shit, coward, whatever, going on and on. And they had like, we know that the communists, all your supporters are communists, and they've given you two women, I think they're referring to like the people leading up my support committee, who are women. They've given you two women.
And this is the Marine commanders that were jumping around you trying to get you to board
the plane? Yeah, they're like trying to argue with me why it's in my best interest to get on the plane.
How did you react?
I just sat there, stared straight ahead and didn't say nothing. That was probably the best thing. They just got really super pissed off.
So the Marine Command reacted with this kind of outrageous behavior, and also eventually, what did they eventually do to you?
Well, after the plane took off, I was ordered to stand and face in the exhaust of the engine turbine, which is bizarre too. But all this was pretty surreal. I was then taken to the military brig at Pearl Harbor, where I stayed for a month until my actual court-martial began. And in short, that whole month of being in the brig and, I think like federal prison, most of, even in the military, the brig's mainly black and Latino and people of color, because it's so arbitrary who goes to the brig in the military and really doesn't care what your crime is. It's like, how does the command think, you could, do something horrendous and not go to the brig because your commander likes you and you do a good job. Whereas, if you got a reputation as, not being a very good soldier.
We'll be returning to Jeff Patterson in just a few moments, right after this week's Spotlight Sound. Please stand by.
This conflict started August 2nd when the dictator of Iraq invaded a small and helpless neighbor.
The crime has nothing to do with invasions, pretty much duplicating what the U.S. had just done a couple of months before in Panama.
Kuwait, a member of the Arab League and a member of the United Nations, was crushed. Its people brutalized. 5 months ago, Saddam Hussein started this cruel war against Kuwait.
He certainly is a brutal tyrant and a mass murderer, just as he was when the U.S. was openly supporting him. The overwhelming majority of his crimes were committed during this period when he was a friend and ally.
While the world waited, Saddam Hussein systematically raped, pillaged, and plundered a tiny nation. No threat to his own.
At the time of the Halabja atrocities and later atrocities against the Kurds, the atrocities were being carried out with the support of George Bush and Margaret Thatcher.
He subjected the people of Kuwait to unspeakable atrocities. And among those maimed and murdered, innocent children.
Attack on the Kurds in northern Iraq destroyed large agricultural areas, well, it's killing plenty of people, probably tens of thousands.
Innocent children.
Plenty of people, probably tens of thousands.
Murdered.
That gave Bush an opportunity to do a favor for a big U.S. agribusiness, send extensive credits to Saddam Hussein so he can purchase agribusiness exports after they had wiped out the agricultural areas in Iraq.
Others traveled to Baghdad in a variety of efforts to restore peace and justice.
So concerned to evade diplomatic efforts, and they did.
Arab leaders sought what became known as an Arab solution, only to conclude that Saddam Hussein was unwilling to leave Kuwait.
Chief of Staff Powell, in internal discussion, said the problem is that Saddam may withdraw, leaving a puppet regime in place, at which point everyone in the Arab world will be happy. That's what they expected, and they wanted to prevent.
No choice but to drive Saddam from Kuwait by force. We will not fail.
The rebelling Iraqi generals requested from the United States, from General Schwarzkopf, they wanted to obtain, didn't want help, but they wanted access to captured Iraqi arms that they could use in their effort to overthrow the tyrant and carry out a popular revolution. That was refused. They were not permitted access to arms. Saddam Hussein was authorized to use military gunships to attack the rebels.
Air attacks are underway against military targets in Iraq. Our operations are designed to best protect the lives of all the coalition forces by targeting Saddam's vast military arsenal.
The bombers destroyed dams, water supply stations, sewage stations.
Military arsenal.
Pumping stations, electrical system. All of that amounts to biological warfare. You can simply ask yourself what would happen if something comparable was done, say, in Boston. People would be dying like flies from disease and starvation.
Unspeakable atrocities.
Biological warfare with exactly the catastrophic effect that they predicted.
Iraq will eventually comply with all relevant United Nations resolutions, and then, when peace is restored, it is our hope that Iraq will live as a peaceful and cooperative member of the family of nations, thus enhancing the security and stability of the Gulf.
The rebellion was crushed. Basra was devastated. So were other areas. And the Bush administration was pretty frank about the reasons. It was March 1991, after the so-called war. They simply preferred what they called an iron-fisted Iraqi junta to the threat of a popular revolution.
Cooperative members.
And therefore had to, in the name of what's called stability
of the Gulf,
had to support these major atrocities.
Unspeakable atrocities.
In which, very possibly, as many or more civilians were killed during the bombing the month earlier.
We will not fail.
From the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, you're listening to the Weekly Freak Show. Please stay tuned for contact information at the end of this half-hour broadcast. You just heard the Soundbite Brigade with this week's spotlight sound, Iraq Debated. The Soundbite Brigade is a group trying to promote and mobilize protests through soundbites, whether they be collages, speeches, lectures, or music. We now return to Old Lady Scar Arms speaking with Jeff Patterson, who's describing what the military courts how the military courts treated him.
One of the charges against me was disclosing classified material and information. They dropped that charge, and eventually I found out it was because the clerk in the general's office made a point to shred my classified documents, my paper stating that I had classified clearance. And he just basically, he whispered to me, I don't like you, but I hate the general even more. And basically that was his way of getting back at the general, in his, view of things, made his life miserable.
Did any other Marines take any type of stand at all?
People applied, there were some people applied for conscientious objector status on that base. Nobody else at that time, refused to fight or anything like that.
Did anyone show any other gestures of support to you?
It really is hard to say, because almost every day there was something that could have turned out bad that didn't. And mainly it was because, it wasn't that everybody was for the war. There was a lot of questioning.
So you you refused to go to the Gulf, and they prosecuted you. What eventually happened with that? Were you imprisoned?
I was in prison waiting trial, and during my trial, I went back and forth from the courthouse to the brig. It was like 6 weeks or so of awaiting trial, and the war's building up, and during this time, there was an anti-war movement that was building, Santa Cruz, there was protests. San Francisco, there were small protests, which got bigger and bigger and bigger. And same thing in Hawaii. There's a small core of people at first, but as August and October and then November, people realized that the U.S. was serious. It wasn't a bluff. Tens of thousands of people were going to die. My trial started. I made every point to, just view my particular trial as one way to, oppose the war in general. Not just like, my particular case and the little legalities of, whether I refused to officially, all that kind of little nitpicky stuff. But just turn it around and put the whole war on trial. And that just, pissed them off even more. And they didn't really know how to deal with that. And all those things came together, and the military just saw that the protesters outside of the gate, every day, people locking themselves to the gate, with free Jeff signs. But they had a war to fight. They were still deploying thousands of people. And this was such a thing of debate. One day, instead of, a week into my trial, prosecutors arguing that, for the sake of national security, I need to be in prison in Leavenworth for 5 years. Nothing less will do. Somebody made a decision higher up on the chain of command that they just need to get rid of me quickly. And the way they did that was they just discharged me.
And you think this was possibly a result of all of the protests that were drawing attention to your case?
There is no doubt in my mind that if it wasn't for those supporters, if it wasn't for those protesters at the gate, if it wasn't for that relatively small core of people on my defense committee, there's no doubt in my mind I would have done at least 2 years in Leavenworth. military learned from that also. You know, subsequent people who refused to fight were sent to, like, South Carolina, to a base in the middle of the bayou, you know, isolated, you know, from any supporters, isolated from lawyers that would defend them. You know, and 150 people in the U.S. military eventually, you know, made public statements against the war. Some of them promised to refuse to fight. And 100 of those people eventually did do time in prison.
And that's all for this week's program. Thanks for listening. The Weekly Freak Show is produced live in the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, and can also be heard on Micropower 102.9 FM, BLR 104.1 FM, Free Radio Madison 87.9 FM, Radio Free Cascadia 98.5 FM, and on the web at unbrokenchain.net and PerumpRadio.com. The Weekly Freak Show can be reached at P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061. Once again, that's P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061. Or send email to frsc@microradio.net. That's frsc@microradio.net. And don't forget, you can always listen to the great shows on Freak Radio by pointing your browser to www.microradio.net/frsc. Again, that's www.microradio.net/frsc. Our theme music was arranged and performed by Neil Norman and his Cosmic Orchestra. For Old Lady Scar Arms and everyone here at Freak Radio, my name's the V-Man, and that's a wrap.